I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, we're going to ask the question, is there room in law anywhere for Sharia law? A Muslim legal scholar from Sudan says no. But first to China. Air raid sirens and car and bus horns sounded today as China stood still for 3 minutes at the exact moment when last Monday's quake first shook the earth there and killed thousands. New York Times correspondent David Barboza joins us from Mianyang in Sichuan Province. David, first of all, the sound of today's morning is chilling. Did it take place near the epicenter of the earthquake as well?
It did indeed. I mean, all over China, in fact. Once the government decrees something, the entire country follows. And I think in basically every city, people stood on the streets. Restaurants marched their waiters and waitresses out on the streets, and they all bowed their heads. And so it was a pretty extraordinary 3 minutes of silence, but also of honking.
Yeah, it sounds extraordinary. We understand also that as we've reported on China's internet, it's controlled by the state, and we understand anyone online during those 3 minutes was automatically switched over to earthquake fundraising sites?
That's right, and also a lot of the sites were forced to put up earthquake-related, just sort of like black, and anchors wore black and white, and entertainment sites were told to either shut down or to put something related to the quake.
And this is part of 3 days of national mourning ordered by the government, flags at half-mast. That's understandable. But we also understand all public entertainment canceled for 3 days. You know, what is this telegraphing to the Chinese people?
I think, you know, the government really wants to drive the message home that this is a time of mourning and not a time of commerce. And I guess if the government decrees it, I'm not so sure how they're going to enforce it and decide what is entertainment and what is not. But they're pretty serious and they have pretty strong controls. And so cinemas are not going to be showing films, and stores are not supposed to have sales. And there's you'll have to check in the cities in the next couple of days, but a lot of stuff has been ordered to stop.
Well, the government has raised the number of dead from the quake to 34,000. Chinese seismologists now have raised the power of the quake from 7.9 to 8.0. And the numbers are still being tallied. I mean, you write today about the rescue workers who've been killed over the weekend. What happened there?
Well, there was a landslide, and this massive landslide buried not only about 158, 200 by some accounts, in mud, but also buried trucks and cars. And there have been lots of warnings, actually, in the last couple of days about the landslides and about floods and things. And in fact, just moments ago, I heard that they're projecting, the Chinese government is projecting, that between tonight and tomorrow, they're expecting an aftershock, which is almost the size of the earthquake. We're still trying to confirm that, but it seems the state-run media is reporting there could be a pretty amazing aftershock centered in Wenchuan, which is the epicenter of the quake, and it could rock this area again and also really do some serious damage to the rescue efforts. There are over 140,000 soldiers and relief workers in this area trying to still dig out people, and they're still finding a few survivors.
Well, I'm going to jump in to say your colleague Ed Wong writes a phenomenal story about a couple who were locked in an embrace under the rubble, a married couple, and rescued. She had to have her arm amputated, but just, you know, reading about, you know, how they, you know, inhaled and exhaled together to try to stay alive. I mean, it's just astonishing. But the fact that there may be another huge, you know, these are rare, an 8.0 earthquake. The fact that there may be another huge one, this is chilling, David. What are people supposed to do?
People aren't sure what to do. They're not sure whether this is really going to happen. There have been aftershocks, hundreds if not thousands of aftershocks that people have gotten used to that have measured up to 5 and 6. But this one tomorrow, they're projecting, is going to be even bigger, and we're not sure how good their projections are, but people are quite nervous. And there are still, as I said, a few miracles that are occurring where they're finding people after a week they're finding them alive in the rubble.
Well, David, we also understand that the Chinese government is asking the international community for tents because so many houses are gone, letting in, you know, as you said, a lot of foreign relief workers. Your sense of, you know, of course, the most important story here is what's happening to people, but your sense of where this event is playing out in Chinese history?
Well, certainly if you're watching how the state-run media is covering it and seeing and talking to people inside China, this is not just an epic quake. I mean, the biggest quake in over 30 years, but it has really been an incredible story for the Chinese people all over. It's not just the Chinese government decreeing that there ought to be a 3 days of mourning. It's actually there was some pressure from people on the internet and others saying that something like this should be done. They've only done this on rare occasions, for instance, when Chairman Mao died in 1976 and a few other occasions. I mean, when you think of the scale of this, 50,000 people or more killed, and the way they've been killed, and in the thousands of children who have been killed, and this stuff is being shown on television. The programs are airing 24 hours a day of rescue efforts, of parents crying, of children lost. So you can imagine if this was in any country, what kind of impact this would have.
That's New York Times correspondent David Barboza speaking to us from the city of Mianyang in Sichuan Province, China. David, thank you, and take care.
Thank you very much.
Christian-Muslim relations were the subject of a meeting this month between Pope Benedict and Rowan Williams, the Archbishop of Canterbury. The Archbishop stepped into a cultural minefield earlier this year, provoking an uproar for suggesting that the body of Islamic law known as Sharia ought to play some role in the British legal system, for instance, to resolve disputes in family law cases involving Muslims. Our next guest is a Muslim, a professor of law, and a leading expert on religion, law, and human rights, and he wholeheartedly disagrees. Abdullah Ahmed An-Naim is a professor of law at Emory University. He's from Sudan. He taught law at the University of Khartoum before leaving in the mid-80s for political reasons. His new book is entitled Islam and the Secular State, Negotiating the Future of Sharia. In it, he argues for what you might call the separation of mosque and state. Professor, welcome to our studios.
Thank you. Thank you, Robin.
Let's start with the Archbishop of Canterbury. He tried to clarify his statement by saying, we're not talking about parallel jurisdictions. He's not calling for a two-tiered system of law. But what do you think of Sharia having, you know, even some role in a judiciary?
If you are talking about acceptance of religious pluralism in British society, religion plays through politics, through social, cultural institutions, into influencing is ultimately law in every country. But if I was talking of enforcement of Sharia principles by English courts, I think that would be very bad and wrong.
You're saying that as more and more Muslims become part of the culture in Britain, they may start influencing laws that are made but don't make separate law for them.
Absolutely, yes.
Well, you give an example of how sort of a separate religious arbitration outside of the court is used, and you don't agree with this either, in Ontario. Explain that.
In Ontario, there was a move by some Muslims to join what is already happening to other religious communities, Jewish communities, for example, to have arbitration of family law matters and commercial law matters outside the courts, and then have Canadian courts enforce the conclusions of the arbiters. My objection is, when we claim that what the arbiters are doing are enforcing Sharia, and therefore Canadian courts enforcing Sharia, that violates the principle of separation of church and state, in my view.
You wouldn't be sure, for instance, that a woman's participation in that arbitration would be full or voluntary.
That's my main concern about the notion of arbitration, because given social pressures and family pressures, I doubt that women will do that voluntarily. And then knowing that Sharia principles, by the way, Sharia is an ancient system. It's not a modern system. It is accumulations of interpretations of Islamic sources over many centuries. And it's a huge sort of corpus of conflicting opinions. So it is not that clear-cut, and it is not that systematic. And therefore, women will be required to submit. I mean, to say that they voluntarily submit is really unrealistic.
That's an interesting point, because it sounds like you're saying you'd also have to decide whose Sharia law are you talking about here.
Precisely.
And let's just back up and define, because the word Sharia means path or path to water, as I understand it. And people in the West who are not familiar with Sharia law, tend to have a negative image in their mind of what it means. For instance, that women are stoned to death, that people's hands are cut off or feet are cut off for theft. But that is not the full image of Sharia.
It is not. In fact, that is extremely, for one thing, all these controversies are extremely recent. Sharia is the totality of the Muslim's obligation, religious obligation, and it is inherently religious. And there is no agreement among Muslims about what Sharia means. On every conceivable issue, Muslims disagree. Therefore, it is not a code by any sense, and it is not a legal body of principles. In fact, what is legal substance is extremely tiny percentage of the totality of Sharia. It goes into the doctrine of the faith, ritual practices, ethics. So the legal subject matter is extremely limited. Now, the point is that a Muslim is bound to observe Sharia as she or he understands and believes it to be. So it's a very personal and it's a very individual obligation of a Muslim.
But then how did it get to be something that we perceive is imposed on Muslims by the state? Let's say in Nigeria, where a woman was almost stoned.
This started in 2000. This was not the case. In Nigeria has been Muslim for centuries. So the point is that the claim that Sharia can somehow be enforced by the state, or the claim that the state can be Islamic, is a post-colonial discourse. It is premised on a European idea of the state and a European idea of law. So what is happening is that a historical tradition, a very complex and very flexible and fluid historical tradition, is now being sort of specifically enforced through state institutions as a hierarchical, bureaucratic, centralized institution, which is alien to the region itself.
And yet you write, if we've got this right, that states can't remain completely neutral when it comes to Sharia law, that Sharia principles can and should be a source of public policy and legislation. That would seem to be contradicting.
It's a paradox, but it is not that contradictory, because in this country, too, Christianity plays that role. I mean, that in every society, the values of a society and its ethical standards are based partially on religious beliefs. Now, for me, the critical question is that they are not enforced as religious doctrine. So you as a Christian, me as a Muslim, can propose legislation, but I cannot say we have to adopt it because God said so.
Well, for instance, it's against the law to murder someone, but we're not necessarily thinking thou shalt not kill.
The law is not about a sin. It is about a crime. So we punish someone not because they committed a sin, but because they committed a crime.
So you say if it bubbles up through the culture, then in your mind it's okay for those kinds of Sharia tenets to become law. But what if, on the other hand, a state forbids the practice of Sharia law?
That would be a violation of freedom of religion. So the state, my point is that Sharia should be independent of the state and the state independent of Sharia, so that the state should not interfere with people's practice of Sharia so long as it is within the law and subject to constitutional safeguard.
Yes, subject to constitutions that countries already have. That's Emory University Professor Abdullah Ahmed Al-Naim. So when we come back, what about banning headscarves? That's in a minute, here and now. We're back with Emory University Law Professor Abdullah Ahmed Al-Naim. He taught law at the University of Khartoum before leaving his native Sudan for political reasons in the mid-80s. His new book is Islam and the Secular State, Negotiating the Future of Sharia. Professor Al-Naim says that Sharia is a personal religious obligation of individual Muslims who can decide on their own how to interpret it. It shouldn't be enforced as law by any government. And Professor, we were flipping the question and asking, but should a government oppose Sharia law? For instance, France bans the headscarf in public life. Does Sharia law require it?
Some Muslims believe that it does. Some Muslims believe that it does not. If you go globally and look at other Muslim societies, you will see that the veiling is a minority practice among Muslims, globally speaking. But the point for me is, the subtitle of the book is Negotiating the Future of Sharia. My point is that what role Sharia has and what it means is negotiable. It is not an absolute, because it is all a subject of human interpretation. So let Muslims, by the way, I disagree with the ban on the veil, as I disagree with requiring women to wear the veil. For me, the point is that it should be the autonomous choice of women. Now, if that choice is not free, then that should be the subject of our focus.
Well, right now, Indonesia, Malaysia, Nigeria allow states or provinces the option of applying Sharia. Only Iran and Saudi Arabia claim to fully implement Sharia. Do you agree that they do?
No, they don't. And nobody does. Sharia is not truly lived by anybody. I'm talking, of course, Sharia with all the reservations about its ambiguity, its complexity. If you think of it, Iran and Saudi Arabia are two diametrically opposed regimes, and they both claim to be Islamic. So what does it mean to be Islamic? Even in those other, like Nigeria, Indonesia, certain provinces, it is a very tiny fraction. You know, usually it is to do with women. Usually it is to do with appearances of banning alcohol. But issues of social justice, issues of corruption, real priority issues are never really given any Sharia consideration.
Well, that brings us to, in Saudi Arabia in particular, why would a state make that claim that they practice Sharia law if in fact they know that that might be offensive to one of their allies, the United States? But why would they make that claim if, in fact, it's, in your mind, not really true?
No, on balance, it is more beneficial for them to make the claim than not to make it. It legitimizes a monarchy, a very oppressive monarchy, to its own population. And also, political opposition will be seen as heresy. So I think the advantage for the regime is that if you criticize me, you are criticizing Islam and therefore criticizing God.
Yeah. You also want to reform Sharia. In fact, you left Sudan in 1985 after your mentor, reformist teacher Mahmoud Mohammed Taha,
yes,
was executed for opposing Sharia, and there was a civil war in the south. So it's a risky business, it would seem.
But yes, but everything worthwhile is risky. I mean, things are worthwhile in life, do not come easy. But I am fortunate that, for me personally, I have been fortunate to be able to live and to be able to live and freely speak my mind. But my question is, what do I owe for that privilege? What I owe is to keep struggling for it and to try to be persuasive. I do not try to be offensive. I do not seek to be sensational, but try to present a solid case for why we need to be clear. By the way, I claim that what I present is, in fact, the reality of Muslims, because there are more than 40 countries where Muslims are a majority in the world. And in most of those 40 countries, Sharia and Islamic states are not an issue at all. If you think of Senegal, of Mali, of Gambia, these are predominantly Muslim countries. It's only in the Middle East region, which we tend to take to represent the rest of the Muslim world, although it is a fraction of the Muslim world. Mm. And therefore, that's what I'm saying, is that the reality of Muslims is, in fact, a reality of secular state, struggle for justice, for human rights, trying to make a living, develop their countries, and so on.
Can you just briefly tell us what you mean by reform Sharia?
By reform Sharia, I mean that it's not me personally, but I'm part of a movement that looks to do this. Sharia is supposed to be interpretation of the Quran and traditions of the Prophet. That is a human endeavor, always a human endeavor. It always has to be contextual. That is, we cannot understand the Quran or the traditions of the Prophet in the abstract, but they are always historical. So the way Muslims in the past understood those sources cannot possibly be the same way that we today will understand those sources. My point is to say I have a right to interpret them in here and now of my society in its global context as they did in their context.
And by that you mean not amputating a hand for the crime of theft, that doesn't...
The whole business of criminal law is thrown out of proportion, and also it's always used to cover a lot more. I mean, Nigeria, as an example, where suddenly in 2000 these northern states come up with these punishments, while
stoning
the level of corruption and mismanagement, incompetence, all sort of egregious injustice is being done, and yet you focus on a few sort of marginal women who are uneducated, who are helpless, and you make an example of them in order to sort of present yourself as pious. It is a total lie, and I think it is totally out of proportion.
Again, going back to the idea of a government covering up its own human rights violations by plastering over Sharia, their interpretation of Sharia law. Are you seen as a heretic?
By some people, yes, and I celebrate heresy, by the way. I think heresy is a very positive thing. Every orthodoxy started as a heresy. So to be a heretic, even if I am, it is not really for me a big deal. I'm happy to be a heretic. And I'm glad to live in a place where being a heretic does not mean that I lose my life for it. And my effort is to make it possible for Muslims to exercise the right to be heretics everywhere without fearing their life or livelihood for it.
Abdullah Ahmed Al-Naim, a professor of law at Emory University. His new book is entitled Islam and the Secular State, Negotiating the Future of Sharia. Professor, thank you so much for speaking to us.
Thank you.
Okay, still ahead today, kids are starting sports activities younger, playing longer and harder, and getting the injuries that only adult athletes used to get. That's after the news, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now.
Set up for corner. Good. Nice. Oh, no, no.
The spring sports season is in full swing. Look out over any school playing field and you're likely to see young athletes throwing, leaping, or headbutting if it's soccer. And if you glance in a hospital waiting room, you'll see the results. Kids lined up waiting for treatment for the many injuries incurred in the pursuit of victory. But as Here Now's Barbara Howard reports, increasingly, their injuries aren't from hard contact. They're from simple overuse.
20-year-old Emily Gibb gingerly limps over to a waiting room chair at the sports clinic at Boston's Children's Hospital, her sore leg in a brace. When this clinic opened in 1974, it saw 200 patients that first year. Now, more than 400 kids a week come here, and most, like Emily, have what are called overuse injuries from playing sports. And no wonder. Emily started playing soccer when she was 7. By the time she was in high school, she was playing soccer all 4 seasons, and she'd added basketball and track to her schedule. And with the year-round sports regime, Emily's legs took a pounding. She says she got little training on how to land a jump safely. So in the spring of her sophomore year at a crucial high school track meet, she heard a loud and painful pop as she pushed herself to win the triple jump competition.
I did win the event, actually. I didn't find that out until the next day when I got back from the hospital. I did win, though.
Were you happy?
I was happy. I qualified for states. I mean, I couldn't go. But I did qualify. But I never jumped or ran track again after that.
Emily tore her ACL, the anterior cruciate ligament, in her knee. It's an injury especially common among girls. She had emergency surgery and was told that she would need another operation to fix her ACL, but that would mean missing fall soccer. So Emily promised her doctor that she'd go easy and have the surgery once fall soccer was over. But just as soccer ended, there was winter basketball, and Emily just couldn't stop herself.
So I sat out for the first 2 days of basketball tryouts, and then I said, I gotta play, give me a brace, I'll do it. And so I went through a whole season of my knee collapsing, you know, in random games and in practices, and I got surgery the day after we lost in the playoffs.
Sitting beside Emily in the waiting room is her mother, Betsy Gibb. She says that she worried constantly about postponing Emily's surgery, but all she could do was wait out the playoffs. Emily finally did get her knee fixed. Betsy Gibb says that as Emily recovered, any thought of giving sports a rest was dashed when Emily was voted captain of both her soccer and basketball teams.
She was a key player, both soccer and basketball teams, so maybe we should have stepped in and said no way, but in all honesty, I think it would have caused a lot of other issues had we stepped in and said, we're overriding your decision to play. I don't know.
If you had it to do over, would you have pulled the plug on it? Or
I don't know.
What would have happened if you'd overridden her?
I never would have talked to you again.
I don't know, but it would have been difficult. I mean, she'd played sports from the time she was in second grade. I mean, it really was a huge part of your character.
The long wait is over, and Emily and her mother are ushered into an exam room where Dr. Lyle McKaylee reads her MRI films. The news is not good. Dr. McKaylee tells Emily that she'll need yet another operation, a third one. A piece of floating tissue from her old injury is what's causing Emily trouble now, and it'll have to be removed. This clinic is now seeing kids as young as 6 for overuse injuries that were once unheard of in children, injuries once reserved for college and professional athletes. The American Academy of Pediatrics says that up to half of all injuries seen in pediatric sports medicine nationwide are related to overuse. Dr. McKaylee says that these types of injuries are all too common.
But overuse comes from overusing, doing too much, sometimes too much over too short a period of time, too much running, too much overhead throwing, too much plié and dance, and that is directly related to how much the kids are doing.
Dr. McKaylee says the intensifying training and extended seasons need to be scaled back. Already, the injury known as Little League elbow is being addressed by limiting the number of pitches thrown by young players. He also wants better trained coaches who can teach their athletes how to avoid injuries and monitor overuse. But careful coaches can still be undermined when children play multiple sports in multiple leagues.
She was one of those players that said, I'm good to go. I'm sure there was times that she wasn't honest with me, especially game situations. So in a game, if she was, it was tight, it was sore, she probably wouldn't tell me.
That's Emily's soccer coach, Kathy Berry. She remembers watching Emily play basketball in the playoffs. She recalls Emily diving for the ball, crashing into the stands. Looking back, Coach Berry wonders if it was right to leave it to Emily to decide when to pull out. As a coach, Berry knows that keeping the best players off the bench and in the game is key.
It's like, are you ready to go in? Can you go in? I need you to go in. You've got 1 minute to, you know, get a drink and rest, and then you need to go back in. So there are those girls that you depend on. And when it comes to the win, you need them to win.
I play for the team, not just for me.
So when it's hurting,
it doesn't matter. If it's a big game, it doesn't matter, at least.
14-year-old Brian Andraconis is also here to see Dr. McKaylee. He slouches in a waiting room chair. He loves soccer and snowboarding, sports hard on legs. Brian says sometimes during soccer, his knee pops out, but he keeps on going.
My knee is, like, bent when it happens, and then it pops out of place, and then when I make my knee back straight, it pops back in.
Does that hurt?
Yeah, it kills.
Do you talk to a doctor when that happens?
Not really. It's just like...
What do your coaches say when it pops out?
Not much. They just like... They know I have knee problems and they like give me a pass sometimes, you know.
Do they let you play sometimes after it's done that?
Yeah, usually. It's whatever I want, basically. If I think I can play.
Andraconis says he has no regrets about playing through the pain. Emily Gibb remembers back to high school when it didn't matter to her either. But now in college, she worries about premature arthritis. She says she's already paying the price.
A lot of my friends at school run 5Ks or run 10Ks, and I can't go for a run with my friends outside. I have to run in a very low impact situation or else my knee swells up and parts move around, and it's just... I mean, it definitely is frustrating. It's an injury that never really went away.
That's college student Emily Gibb speaking with Here Now's Barbara Howard about the injuries Emily sustained from playing high school sports. If you want more information about injuries and young people, go to our website, here-now.org. And while there, tell us what you think. We want your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org, or you can give a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. Okay, quick heads up. Mark your calendars. Tomorrow, a music-drenched conversation with rock and roll icon Steve Winwood. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, it's Monday. That must mean a new record high for gas prices. A new AAA survey puts the nationwide average for regular unleaded gas at $3.79 a gallon. And experts say we could see average prices reach that $4 a gallon. Well, if you're looking for ways to use less gas, here's an idea. Stop making left-hand turns. Think about it. Turning left wastes gas because you're left idling while you wait for an opening in the traffic. But can you really get where you need to go by only turning right? UPS thinks so. They've told their drivers to steer clear of left turns, and they say in the process they're cutting millions of miles off their routes. Michael Hance is the vice president for UPS's automotive engineering and operations. Michael, it sounds kind of counterintuitive because if you turn right instead of making the left you want to make, aren't you going out of your way? It seems you'd be driving more and leaving a bigger carbon footprint. But you say it turns out you're not because avoiding left-hand turns, you're reorganizing your delivery routes completely?
Exactly. And in most cases, we divide our routes up where the main street is the dividing point. One person would do the odd side and make right turns off of that, and the other person would do the even side and might make right turns. And it's pre-planned that way. The packages are actually loaded in the vehicle in order so the drivers can continue to make the right turns off the main roads and deliver to the businesses and residences.
It's wild. How much mileage do you really think you're saving?
We've actually saved 3 million gallons of fuel just in 2007 alone, and we reduced 30 million miles off of our vehicles as a result of that, and 32,000 metric tons of CO2 last year were reduced.
Well, what else do you do? Because we understand this is part of a program of trying to cut your footprint.
We also have telematics devices that we have installed on our vehicles, and they are sensors for the engine with a little box on the car that has a GPS unit in there that measures the route of the driver mm-hmm. and shows their path through the day. If they're making left turns or going too far off route or overlapping with another driver, we have the ability to see that with the GPS unit and then change our dispatch so we can make that route more efficient the next day.
Well, and you also are sort of keeping an eye on your drivers in other ways. We understand that you train them to avoid harsh braking or rapid accelerations, which we know consume, you know, just a little more fuel and then exponentially a lot more. But you're able to actually see if they're doing that?
Yes. We call it telematics. It's actually sensors that are on the car that measure the path of the vehicle, but also measures the braking, seatbelt usage, fuel economy, backing, and many of the engine diagnostics, too, to help us measure the length of time that our components last in the vehicle, to help us develop a better maintenance program, too.
How do you feel about the local movement? You know, as people become more aware of their carbon footprints, they're noticing that, for instance, when they FedEx a letter just one town away, it may be shipped all the way to the company's Memphis hub and then flown back and delivered. You know, there are people trying to reduce the number of packages sent to reduce that carbon footprint. Are you noticing your volume falling off?
In the U.S., with the economy the way it is right now, our volume is pretty well flat, but around the other parts of the world, we have some great growth, especially in Asia and in Europe, and that helps compensate and balance out our operation.
By the way, what are the drivers saying? Do they find this a pain in the whatever to make all right-hand turns? Or?
We actually have about six key driving tips that we use with our drivers. One of them is the left turns, but we also have planning the route properly, vehicle maintenance, driving responsibly, using the best vehicle available. And these tips our drivers use not only on the job, but many of them take them home and use them in their personal life, too, to help save fuel on their personal vehicles and their family.
That's Michael Hance. He's the vice president for UPS's automotive engineering and operations. They're instructing their drivers to, when they can, not make left-hand turns. Michael, thanks for talking to us about it.
Thank you.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe it came from you.
I'm gonna write. And speaking of delivering mail, a new stamp is out honoring Frank Sinatra. What better excuse to honor him and play his music? We'll do that later this week. Coming up next, one of the first highly acclaimed books of the summer. It's a novel told through a collection of 13 short stories. That's in 1 minute, here and now.
And close with love the way you do.
In In Elizabeth Strout's new collection of short stories, we meet the title character Olive Kittredge slowly. In the first story, Olive is the infrequently glimpsed and blunt-speaking wife of pharmacist Henry Kittredge. You wonder why the lovely Henry stays with her, but as he says, to leave Olive would be as unthinkable as sawing off his leg. Their son is named Chris.
Olive can understand why Chris has never bothered having many friends. He is like her that way, can't stand the blah, blah, blah. And they'd just as soon blah, blah, blah about you when your back is turned. Never trust folks, Olive's mother told her years ago after someone left a basket of cow flaps by their front door. Henry got irritated by that way of thinking, but Henry was pretty irritating himself with his steadfast way of remaining naive, as though life were just what a Sears catalog told you it was, everyone standing around smiling.
In the second story, we learn Olive was once a teacher. She happens to show up as a former student, contemplates suicide. In the third, she appears in a cameo as a patron in the local bar, a wave of a hand, and that's it. She's gone. But through 13 tales, a complex picture of Olive Kittredge emerges like a Polaroid developing. Both the New York Times and the New Yorker have given Olive Kittredge rave reviews. USA Today calls it glorious, powerful stuff, and we concur. Author Elizabeth Strout joins us in the studio. Welcome and congratulations.
Oh, thank you. It's lovely to be here.
You sort of hit one here. How would you describe Olive? Who is she? A part of her is Maine, we should say. Her blunt speaking is partly.
Yes, I think that she is a product of where she comes from, which is many generations of that have produced Olive Kittredge on the coast of Maine. So she does have a bluntness. She does have a certain personality that almost aligns itself with the cragginess of the coastline itself.
The and the clipped speech.
Yeah. Yeah.
And as the Times said, the clucking of communal disapproval. She has a little of that sort of.
Oh, absolutely. She has a great deal of of different disapprovals. Yes.
But what else would you say about her?
I think of Olive as being quite ferocious in her needs and unapologetic in going about getting what she needs in a way that makes her stand out as a rather powerful character and in many ways, I think, recognizable to ourselves, although hopefully we're not quite as direct and forthright about what we need and how blind one can be, she can be, we can be to the pain that we cause others.
And yet she is, grossly overweight herself, but she weeps over a young girl who's got anorexia.
Absolutely. She's a strange combination, as I think many people are. She's very sensitive to the needs of others. However, those are people generally that are not as close to her.
Right.
The closer you get to Olive, the more her needs will consume you.
Or that she can't express to you appropriately what her needs are. She loves her son but drives him away. She puts her husband down at every opportunity, but thinking of him gone squeezes her heart so hard. She felt like a package of vacuum-packed coffee. Her heart has been stopped by events in her life.
Absolutely. The accumulation of losses has been something that has brought her great, great sorrow. And she does have heart. She has a fierce heart that can feel for people in all directions. But she's very intense, and her heartache is intense.
Yeah. Well, and we don't want to give away too much of the stories because there's so many of them, and we get just a little bit from each one. But you know, having to do with a father who said to her years earlier, you know, sometimes I feel like ending it all. And she says, oh, Dad, sometimes we all feel that way. Well,
right. And then she has to live. And then she lives with that. And that's a, you know, unspeakably terrible thing.
Yeah, terrible
for
loss.
For anybody to have to go through. And it obviously has made its mark on her.
And is that, you know, a parent's suicide? Is that what sometimes shuts off her heart?
I think so. I think that it was a blow that was so large, and she, with her particular background and her time that she's living in, I mean, current time, she's really unable to understand the depth of that blow to herself and the effect that it's going to have throughout her life on others as well as herself.
Why did you introduce her to us this way? Why did you do it through these short stories? She's not even in some of them.
Right. It came to me unconsciously. The first story that I wrote of Olive was the first marriage of her son. And I think that I understood right away that she's such a forceful character that the reader is going to kind of need a break. And I saw it episodically more than in a traditionally layered kind of novel. And so it developed that way. It wasn't completely deliberate. It really was sort of unconscious that I would just write these different stories about Olive. And then I realized that it, for me anyway, I think it has the heft of a novel when you put it all together. And I'm very interested in point of view. So I love the chance to see her through the eyes of other people in the community, some who know her well, some who don't know her as well.
That's the magnificent part of this, because you find yourself thinking, oh, next time I go to Maine or anywhere, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're looking around, and that woman walking down an alley at night with her hand on the wall might have had a few drinks to steady herself so she can play at the piano at the bar.
Right.
And she might cross an intersection, and Olive might cross the other
way.
And they have these... There's an interconnectedness that you start to realize that people in the background of a scene might be in the foreground the next day.
Right. That was very fun for me to do that, to give so-called minor characters the center stage every so often and to see, you know, what their life was like. And then to get that glimpse of Olive as opposed to having a full front view that we have in the other stories.
Well, the other thing it does is it reminds you of the thing that Olive doesn't seem to really see. Well, you know what? Maybe I'm not sure anyone does. I mean, we're all the stars in our own play, but you realize in the way you've told this is that everybody is. I mean, Olive may be the star of the book, but everybody comes forward.
That's right. That's right. Everybody is the star of their own show, and everybody's inner universe is their main focal point. And we see the others as they pass by us, and that's always interested me so much. And so to be able to use it in this book in that way was really gratifying.
I'm wondering... You know, we're here in Boston, we're heard across the country, but, you know, perhaps there's someone up in Maine or New Hampshire, you know, that you'd rather not hear the answer to this, but was there someone, some prickly person who was sort of unlikable that helped draw you into this character, you know? There's got to be something there to that person that is unlikable.
Well, I come from many generations of Maine. I think on one side there's 8 generations, on the other side there's 10. That's a lot of ancestry if you add it up. And so... Even though I have lived outside the state of Maine for many, many years, this is a part of my background. These are characters or a compilation of different characters that I've known, certainly in my childhood, and just a kind of understanding, especially having lived away from Maine, I have a different looking back on it or when I go up to visit. You know, I see that, you know, all regions have their own signatures, and so this character came from many experiences and many people that had passed my way.
People who had what, as you said, become like the landscape?
People who don't mince their words, people who are not particularly concerned with the niceties and will say what they perceive to be the truth.
Well, that's Olive Kittredge.
Yes.
And in the final analysis, again, we're not going to give it away, but, you know, really tells the truth about herself.
Yes, she does. Too. If there's one thing you can say about Olive, she's pretty truthful. She has blind spots about herself, as we all do, but she's pretty truthful about...
Yeah, in the end.
In the end.
Do you want people to like Olive?
I've been around with this book now, going around, and it's been quite amazing how many different responses there are. Many people will come up to me and whisper, I'm like Olive. Or they might come up and say, my wife is like Olive. Other people say, you know, she's a little too hard to take. But I have been very surprised that many, many people end up liking her. I think the most common thing I've heard is, I didn't like her at the beginning of the book. By the end of the book, I missed her dreadfully and I loved her. And I really want them to feel whatever they feel. The book belongs to them at this point.
That's Elizabeth Stroud. Her new collection of short stories is called Olive Kittredge. Elizabeth, thanks so much.
Thank you.